bet. Oh, it always feels good when it drops. So it's Friday, it's TYT, it's also a power panel, not necessarily in those that particular order, but I'm John, we got JR, we got Jimmy, three different flavors of J's, and pretty big day.
Okay. Somewhat.
Pretty big day in news.
Kinda.
We're getting ready for a big trip, an opportunity for our president to make our country look better around the globe. I'm excited, I don't know if you guys are excited.
Oddly, I am.
You are?
I was talking before about how it's this collision of emotions every time you pay attention to anything in our
political world. Yeah.
It's an odd excitement, and it's disappointment and anger, fear, laughter, crying.
That's what the show is going to be.
All
anger, fear,
time.
Laughter, crying. We might hurl. We'll see. Anyway, lots to get to. A little preview of some of the stuff we're going to cover. We're selling a buttload of weapons to Saudi Arabia. We're going to get to that shortly. Another federal department, very important, especially for lower income Americans, getting its budget slashed. We're going to break down the implications of that. And then we've got a potential new head of the FBI. You've probably heard about it, but if you haven't, brace yourself. It's a blast from the past. But anyway, with that, we're going to jump into the first big story of the day. Amid a growing scandal here in the US, Donald Trump is about to head out on a big 9-day multiple country tour of the Middle East and Europe, representing the US abroad for the first time. Now, this trip is going to have a lot of big opportunities for him and the US, but also some potential pitfalls. And in this video, we're going to be breaking down some of those. And once we get past the big points, JR was able to track down some instructions that are being given to foreign leaders and dignitaries in how to approach Trump. It's just awesome. But anyway, we're going to start off with the trip. Now, the big one, of course, is Saudi Arabia. So he's going to be going to Saudi Arabia. He's going to be delivering a speech on Islam, which should be exciting. It's being written by Stephen Miller, I believe.
It's going to be the best speech ever.
It's already got great reviews, and it hasn't even happened. In fact, CNN declared that he won that speech.
His advisor, Stephen Miller, just for people who don't know, because I mean, Stephen Miller is kind of a normal name.
Yeah.
He was also one of the architects for his executive order that put the ban on the seven Muslim countries the first time around, before it went down to six, then back up to seven, and then 7.2. So this is the guy who's written a speech for Donald Trump to half-assedly read while he's in front of
him. So the Stephen Miller ban is a lot different than the Stevie Miller ban.
Yes. Yeah.
Right, abracadabra.
Yes. Some people like one, some people like the other. But the guy is a huge Islamophobe, and look, Trump, he has said a lot of incendiary things about Islam before. Now, is he going to receive a poor reception in Saudi Arabia? Perhaps. We're about to get into a gigantic arms deal. We're about to sign with them. So that usually smooths the path a little bit in international diplomacy. If you're giving them weapons, they'll usually be okay with the things you've said before. There are some potential other roadblocks in Saudi Arabia, though. I'm reading that he's going to be at a dinner thrown by the Saudis, a royal banquet. One of the invitees is Omar Bashir, president of Sudan, who is currently wanted for war crimes, including genocide. And I just don't think that Trump is going to be able to stop himself from condemning an autocrat. That's what he does, okay? He's going to get in the guy's face. He's going to tell him what's what. Probably not. But he is going to be giving that speech on Islam, and so that should be exciting. I don't know if the entire thing is going to be about radical Islam and how it's responsible for all the bad stuff in the world, but
I think that he should probably give a speech on good manners. And then he should give a speech on hair combing, and then he should give a speech on tie length. Then he should give a speech.
Tie length, yes.
What else could he give a speech? He should then give a speech on digital, and then he should give a speech on.
Yeah, there's not too much I would consider him an expert on. And even the areas where he clearly has some knowledge, he ain't a good speaker.
Right.
So we're going to find out what was in that speech, but it's going to take a couple days.
You try to put yourself in a position. So I'm sorry if you're going to get to more details, but he's going to go on this long extended trip. 9 days, and it seems exhausting. I read through the details of what they're planning to have him do, who's he supposed to meet with here on this day and that time, and how long he's going to stay. I know you're going to get to all those details. But just in reading through it, I was like, man, it's a little exhausting, right?
Nine
I went
days.
Just to DC for a weekend for all the correspondence stuff, and I didn't sleep, and I barely ate, and I was like, oh.
Yeah.
But You didn't know this was coming? I was preparing for it. So just, in, I hope I'm not like exposing or spoiling, but he originally wanted part of the, one of the things, apparently he's been traipsing around the White House, frustrated and annoyed because this is a 9-day trip. And he's like, can we just shorten it down to maybe 5 days?
Yeah.
I don't want to be out of the country for too long. I don't want to be flying around. It's just too much trouble.
Which, by the way,
like, what am I, the president?
Like, I guess in his defense, maybe hypothetically, like, he liked traveling around the US giving speeches during the campaign. How different is this really? And also, the dude apparently is only, he's not interested in being president really, but he loves the luxury, the prestige. Yeah. This is a trip where the leaders of foreign countries are gonna wine and dine you for 9 days while trying to get the US to give them various sorts of benefits. And he just gets to eat fancy dinners and sleep in the nicest beds in the world. That doesn't seem that difficult.
He has to read.
But he does have to read, yes. So in addition to Saudi Arabia, he is then going to fly to Israel, which I am reading is actually the first direct flight from Saudi Arabia to Israel ever. So history being made, there you go.
So are you gonna, so this part about where this Bashir from the Sudan is gonna be there?
Rumored.
So, yeah. Well, it says
they said he's gonna be
Sudan's
there.
Foreign minister has said Bashir's coming and Sudan is looking forward to normalizing relations with the US. He's considered he's a war criminal, right?
Yeah.
And so that's why it would be awkward.
It would be a little bit awkward, yes.
And then also like Jamie Dimon and all those guys are gonna go hang out.
I did not know Jamie Dimon was gonna be
Isn't
there.
That wild?
I guess at this point we just have to expect that Jamie Dimon and a representative of the Koch brothers will be at every fancy dinner.
And Dow Chemicals Andrew and Liveris is going to be there. They're going to join the Saudis.
Yeah. Yeah, well, look, I mean, to some extent, there's the military angle, but then there's also the huge foreign investment they're trying to set up, two-way investment, and banking and chemicals, oil, all that stuff. I mean, those big businesses conceivably could make a lot of money off of this. And that's not unique to Trump, really. That's the same sort of thing that Obama would have done.
Yes.
Like, they always want to get the money flowing in both directions. Neither of those directions are us, unfortunately.
Right.
Saudi Arabia, you know, heart of Islam, obviously, origin of Islam. He goes to Israel, also significant religious origin stories there, too. So, I mean, to some extent, there's a theme growing in this trip. But also, I mean, he has to consider that there are some overlapping interests between Saudi Arabia and Israel in terms of regional security and stuff like that. But there are certainly some things that they do not overlap on. There were, however, a few interesting notes in some of our reading on this. One was that he wanted to land his helicopter at the ancient fortress in Masada. People were worried, however, that would damage the place. And so they said, no, what you can do is, like past presidents, you can land your helicopter and take a cable car up to it. It's a compromise. And so he responded like a responsible person, said, fuck it, I'm not doing the entire thing at all. No, if I can't land my helicopter, I ain't going. So he won't get to see what must be an amazing ancient fortress in Israel. He also is going to visit the Holocaust Memorial and said he plans to spend just 15 minutes there. And part of going to Israel is to address critics who say that he has spread anti-Semitic memes before. He's been far, he hasn't really cared when there have been attacks on synagogues and things like that. Discussion of the Holocaust on the Memorial Day earlier this year didn't actually reference Judaism. So there are concerns that he's sort of turning a blind eye to anti-Semitism. So to go there and say, okay, I'm gonna go to your Holocaust Memorial Museum, but I'm not even gonna stay as long as an episode of Friends. just stay a little bit longer, you fool.
Oh.
Who wouldn't want to, like, think about the experience of being there. Just be a human for a second. You're finally traveling. Learn something from it.
Because learning something doesn't have to do with himself. I don't know if we brought up actually on the show or if it was just discussed. There's the whole situation with, in order for him to read even enough press, not even press briefings, intelligence briefings about what he's supposed to do in the world and prepare, they have to insert his name randomly
National
so that he can be like,
Council
oh, that's
officials.
Right, I'm gonna jump down to paragraph 3 because I saw Donald Trump again there when I saw something about a threat.
but they say he'll keep reading if his name is in it enough.
So with that in mind, it has to have something to do with himself. What does an ancient, what was it?
The fortress.
An ancient fortress have to do with him? Nothing. What does he have to do with, what was the next part?
The Holocaust.
What does the Holocaust have to do with Donald Trump? Oh my God, he wasn't there.
You know,
was Donald Trump in the Holocaust? No, he has nothing to do with that, so he doesn't care.
No, go ahead.
He doesn't see himself as anti-Semitic or Holocaust denier, and I completely believe him. It's just, it doesn't have anything to do with him. I don't hate him.
It's
I
a lack
just don't
of interest,
care.
Really, yeah.
The only people who say he's anti-Semitic are the Jews. Anyway, so, but
I just. To be fair, a bit biased.
A bit, yeah. This is breaking news, I want to give it. Trump just canceled his trip to the Vatican because the Pope won't let him land Air Force One on Jesus' pickled foreskin. It's a true story. I just got this breaking.
Fucking Jimmy Dore. Okay. Thank you for bringing up that he's going to the Vatican. We're going to turn to that in 1 second, you jackass. Anyway, also, like, I wasn't just joking earlier when I said that there are opportunities. So he has said that he wants to, like, pursue in a dedicated way peace between Israel and Palestine. That's why he put a professional diplomat like Jared Kushner in charge of it. But when he's in Israel, he is going to be meeting with Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian Authority. And so there's theoretically the possibility that they could make some progress on that. The Israelis might be a little bit frustrated that he doesn't care at all about their memorials and goes for 15 minutes. But there is still a possibility. So fingers crossed something good could actually come out of this because a lot of people's lives do depend on it. But as Jimmy said, he is going to the Vatican as well. Pope Francis has said that people who build walls are not Christians. So it could be a tense meeting, admittedly. But again, I mean, this is a pope who's so far, the past few years, seen fit to engage in world politics, speak out on important social issues, climate change and that sort of thing. He's not a through and through progressive or anything like that, but it is a nice change and improvement from past popes. And so there is a chance that considering how influential he is, the amount of gold they'll be surrounded by, that maybe it'll rub off a bit on the president.
So that's the thing. I think Donald Trump and the Pope have a lot in common, and I think that's why they get along, because only in the Vatican and in Trump's house can you hear, hey, the toilet's stuck, jiggle the solid gold handle.
The Pope really needs to lay off the gold. It's not a good look for the person who's supposed to care about the poor. And then, of course, we also have
the Pope said he's not going to judge Trump, by the way. Did you hear that part?
Really?
He says, I never want to judge someone before I listen to the person first. Apparently, he doesn't have a TV.
Well, Trump just hasn't spoken much over the past couple of years. He's a tight-lipped fellow. So he's also going to be going to Belgium and to Italy. He's going to be meeting the new leader of France, Macron. Obviously, there are going to be discussions about the future of NATO. There's an organization that Trump regularly criticized throughout both the primary and the general election. Now, his rhetoric has been a little bit more, I guess, open to the future of NATO existing in the future recently, but he's been incredibly critical of it in the past, which worries a lot of European states. And so it is likely that that will come up as well during this trip.
And again, it's another, his speech, at least his comments to NATO were also written by same Stephen Miller, who also in the past has had his negative comments to say about NATO and the existence of and our commitment to them.
Exactly.
Before going to the G7 as well as the last leg of the trip.
So he is going to see Angela Merkel, and I just wonder if he's going to give her that carotid clutch, George Bush. I mean,
he's going to grab at her.
The Republicans overseas don't do well.
No, that's true.
George Bush fucking.
Yeah. And his father, of course, throwing up.
That's more of an involuntary thing. But then, when he was in Africa, he's doing whoo-hoo. Remember he was dancing? Yeah. Like, what the?
I found that to be endearing.
Okay. All right, I'll give you that. Look, I'll give you that.
The guy's still a war criminal, killed hundreds of thousands of people, but he was a cool dancer. Now, during this big overseas trip, which as we've alluded to is going to last 9 days, a lot's going to be happening here, a lot also going to be happening abroad. And so there have been suggestions to foreign dignitaries and leaders on how they should approach Trump. So let's go over a few of those.
This is unbelievable.
Among them are suggestions to compliment Trump on his election win, compare him favorably to former President Obama, say that he has wondrously long fingers, not to expect him to know your country's history or hot button issues, and make a short presentation tailored to his attention span, and don't try to bring up a long list of issues.
Now, is this the Trump campaign telling other countries this, or is this the other countries figuring it out? Where did this come from?
These are other countries' leaders who've had interactions with him, or at least have spoken and know how, if analyzed and see how he operates, and they know this is the type of guy we're dealing with. This is what you do in order to have a nice, amicable conversation.
Yeah. Oh, no kidding. Okay.
They figured out some of the things. I mean, you basically have to treat him like the kid at the birthday party who everybody knows is a dick, and you're just trying to calm him down a little bit. That's basically what they're going to do. Okay. And look, it's obviously these are funny. That's one of the reasons we're talking about it, is that he is a child. And I despise the man more than anyone else in the world, but we do need to work with other countries. We do need good relationships with foreign leaders. And it's possible that these sort of elementary, basic psychological tricks could actually lead to Trump. Like, we know Trump is incredibly sensitive to whether a person likes them or not. His view of another person is incredibly dependent on if they've criticized him or complimented him. And theoretically, the future of NATO or foreign aid to some of these countries could well depend on them using these sorts of mental judo moves. And so if it helps the world, I'm all for it.
They said even in... I get it. You're trying to get his ego stroked so that you can find a way to speak with him. But then after that, how do you convey any message of any kind of workings or deal making or agreements or disagreements for that matter with a guy who even, let's point this out, they said if he needs an interpreter, which we know he probably needs one even for English, then he doesn't even pay, he can't pay attention to that. And I understand it. When I've listened and watched these press conferences, when it's a foreign leader from a country with a language that I don't speak, and I'm listening to the interpreter, I'm like, man, their voice is different. It doubles over, it's back. So it's a little tough.
Yeah.
But if you care, you can get through it.
Yeah, that's
it's
true.
It's just like with the expectations are so low. They're like, if he has to have an interpreter, he doesn't want to listen to that anymore.
Yeah.
When you say mental judo, is that anti-Semitic?
Jesus. I'm going to have to go to the memorial for longer than 15 minutes to write that wrong. I don't know. I mean, look, any one of these locations, there are justifiably an incredibly long list of issues that they do need to talk about it. He doesn't have the attention span, that's totally true. I guess the hope, fingers crossed, is that if they establish a rapport with him and he has a favorable opinion of that country, then Trump leaves the room or goes to sleep or gets a Diet Coke or whatever. And then the serious diplomats are then given free rein by the president to make good deals. Now, unfortunately, again, we've been talking about this the whole time. We know how these sorts of trips generally go. They're generally about huge expenses on the military, and they're about setting up oil drilling over. Like, a lot of it has nothing to do with our interests. It's about advancing the interests of US and global economic elites. But there's foreign aid, like there's foreign crises. I don't want us to turn our back on the rest of the world. That's all I'm saying. And so it rests on Donald Trump.
I think it's gonna be funny.
It's gonna generate a lot of material for your show.
Hilarious. It's gonna be funny.
I hope someone tries to get him to dance. Have we ever seen Donald Trump dance?
No. No, but he did do the wave a little. When you ever see that videotape of him with Bill O'Reilly? They're at a baseball game. So they're at a baseball game and the wave is coming. So they're in line with, there's like four women next to them. They're young. And so they all do it. And then it comes to Bill O'Reilly and he goes like this. And Trump actually goes like that.
Oh,
he doesn't
more
stand
of a sport.
Up, but he does it.
Well, he couldn't. But or if he did, he would have had to make one of those. But look, he was a sport. I guess that's something.
You know what Bill O'Reilly's doing right now? Bill O'Reilly right now is at home trying to convince his right hand that there's career opportunities in it if it jerks him off.
You've got some impressive sources.
Thank
you.
I can't verify that, but it was a.
You're supposed to get two verifications.
I got
before reporting.
Thad Wheeler told me. Is that his name? Tom Wheeler. What's the Wheeler guy from the?
Oh,
Beth Rich?
Rod Wheeler.
Rod Wheeler. Yeah, that's it. Damn. Fuck. Threw it up to Joker.
The next location, you'll deliver it perfectly. Okay. Let's turn to a specific example of the larger trend that we've been talking about here, because for some reason it's the job of the U.S. government to set up extremely lucrative arms deals with foreign countries. I don't know why, but it is. Whether Democrat or Republican, they go around the world trying to set up these sorts of deals to ship arms around the world. The White House recently had Saudi officials over to discuss a possible deal, and something a little bit weird happened. So the two sides, this is Jared Kushner, head of international arms sales, in addition to everything else, and the Saudis, discussed a shopping list that included planes, ships, and precision guided bombs. Then an American official raised the idea, totally unscripted, of the Saudis buying a sophisticated radar system designed to shoot down ballistic missiles. This is the same radar system, by the way, that received so much discussion about its deployment in South Korea recently to help to counter the possible influence of ballistic missiles from North Korea. The THAAD system, it's called. So, sensing that the cost of that system might be a problem, several administration officials said, Mr. Kushner picked up the phone and called the chief executive of Lockheed Martin, who produces the radar system, and asked her whether she could cut the price. As his guests watched slack-jawed, Mrs. Houston told him she would look into it, officials said, and the early word is that they're going to be able to get some sort of deal. I don't know the exact details of it. And so, I mean, he loves to make deals. That's what Trump and his cronies do. But to arm the Saudis, how much effort they're going into, the personal capital they're willing to expend.
But
I don't understand it.
Especially since Trump's been critical of Saudi Arabia, like off the cuff all the time.
It's a line he goes to.
Maybe he knows it works with his base, maybe, but you know, they're like, hey, those fucking Saudis. Don't worry about it. We're gonna get you your arms. Don't worry about it.
I guess it's a public and a private position, I suppose.
It sounds like it.
I guess
they're not because he's trying to get him deals.
Yeah, you're right. He criticized him throughout the campaign.
Yeah.
Now this is an area though where like so the Jared Kushner thing is a little bit weird. The personal deal making that we don't if it happens normally we don't hear about it normally. So it is weird. But this really isn't all that bizarre historically for the US. So we wanted to put this in context of this deal because there's a lot of details about how some of the weapons that are going to be sold were actually already negotiated under former President Obama. And so we brought up how much we sell to Saudi Arabia year by year. So let's bring up this chart and you're going to see that those are billions there on the left-hand side. It goes back a long time. Now, there have been previous periods where multiple years in a row we sold more generally. But look at that spike under Obama back in 2012. A huge amount of arms being sold to Saudi Arabia specifically in just 1 year. So look, the average is going to shoot up under Trump. That's true. But man, we've been selling them arms for a long time. Has it bought us security? I don't know. There's a lot of trouble coming out of that region and out of Saudi Arabia specifically. A whole lot of those arms sales come before 9/11, oddly enough. And so it looks like off into the future, we're going to continue to do it.
Well, no matter what.
The same policy, Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter. We sell them billions of dollars.
But as we do it, they'll still say this is a new wave of a new way to bring some kind of security and our foothold in the Middle East and have some kind of allies that we're working with to make sure there's peace and stability. And it's a new wave. It's the same wave.
Same wave. So why are we doing it, you think? Why do we sell all the, why do both Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter, Trump's gonna do it now?
I guess to some extent it's trying to make sure that the regime is as positive towards us as possible. Maybe this will limit their funding for terrorism and stuff like that. We like them more than we like some other potential allies or adversaries in the region, I guess they would say. But we also know that a lot of these weapons are gonna immediately be used in Yemen. I know that Iran obviously worried about this because theoretically these weapons could be used on Iran, which would be a gigantic military conflict. Some of it, Israel isn't a huge, Israel is a fan to some extent of some of these weapons being sold because it's an extra buffer against Iran. But they don't necessarily want, especially like the radar system, the ability to shoot down ballistic missiles. Like theoretically the day could come when that cuts a significant ability of our ability to counter Saudi Arabia. And so look, we armed Saddam Hussein in Iraq for years and years and then eventually go to war with him. And I guess we make money coming and going in that case. I guess the same thing will happen here. But to the average American, this chart doesn't make any sense when you can't see the chart. It's the same chart you saw. It doesn't make any sense.
So I think it's because of the petrodollar, which is why we've been overthrowing democratically elected governments in the Middle East and backing strong arm theocracies like this because the CIA does not like democracies because democracies are messy. And sometimes the people vote to keep their natural resources.
Yeah. Sometimes they vote and work towards their own benefit.
Yeah, and so when they do that, we have to go in and do something bad like we do in Haiti. We did in the Banana Wars. American generals.
In Iran.
We did it. Right. Iran. Well, so that was, we got rid of Mossadegh, who was the democratically elected president, and we installed the Shah, which was a puppet, and that's how we got a theocracy, right? Yeah. So that's the pushback to us getting rid of democracies there. So the same thing, by the way, John Kerry testified, I think in 2015, he definitely testified, I don't know what year, but he said that Saudi Arabia, he was trying to impress upon the Senate that Saudi Arabia was committed to overthrowing Bashir in Syria. Yeah. And he said that they had offered to pay for the entire military operation if we did it. So that's what's been happening. We offered to use our military, lend out our military to Saudi Arabia as long as they continue to monetize oil on the petrodollar. Yeah. And that's what this is all about. That's why we're in Syria. It's got nothing to do with helping people, because if we wanted to help people, we would stop selling cluster bombs to Saudi Arabia, who they then drop on fishing villages in Yemen, the poorest people in the world. So the fact that we're trying to overthrow Bashar al-Assad because he's bad to his people is bullshit.
You're saying it's not about beautiful babies?
It's not about beautiful babies, because we
sell... Is it partly about beautiful babies?
It's partly.
Yeah, also, and so look,
this is all about the petrodollar, and that's why we're in the Middle East, and there's no other reason for it.
So what you're saying is our military isn't here to protect us?
No.
That's, get off the set.
I know.
Get off the set.
Wow.
Yeah, and look, if they had done that deal, if we, to some extent we did, but let's say we had invaded Syria and they paid us for it, I mean, does that help out the average American? No. But the military contractors, they don't care what the objective is. It's not like, well, we only get paid if the bomb is dropped on someone truly horrible. No, they get paid either way. Where's the end? How many billions upon you just flood them with cash decade after decade, and it's an endless hunger, killing the rest of us.
26,000 bombs in Syria last year.
Now look, I want to give minimal credit to Obama in this area after criticizing him. Now, one area where they weren't going to help out Saudi Arabia is the Obama administration put a hold on precision-guided munitions. It had agreed to sell the Saudis previously out of fear that they would be used to bomb civilians in Yemen, which they would have been. We know that.
Yes.
The Trump administration has freed up those weapons. So Obama wasn't going to sell them. Now they will be sold. I guess, look, if you're a fisherman in Yemen, maybe you prefer the precision-guided bombs to the cluster bombs, because there's slightly less chance that they're going to sit there for weeks or months or years and be found by a kid and blow up and kill a kid. Like, that's what happens with cluster bombs. But again, it looks like all the bars are gone. Saudi Arabia can do whatever the hell they want. There's going to be no leadership from America for even minimal concern for human rights, even if that's the sort of skin on us advancing the interests of military contractors.
And it's weird that
it's a disastrous situation.
It is. And it's weird that the New York Times says after a strained relationship with Mr. Obama, the Saudi Arabia, they had a strained relationship. He sold them $119 billion worth of fucking arms.
Yeah.
I don't know how strained that is.
Right? Minimally strained.
100% of everything.
I would bet.
It was the.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's going on right now. As we previously said, Trump will be in Saudi Arabia. We'll see if that changes the content of this deal, if any additional weapons or weapon systems are given to them. But that's what we got going on right now.
So his base, though, is pretty non-interventionist, being Trump. I'm not talking the Republican Party. I'm talking Trump's Republican base. And they're non-interventionist. So every time he does something interventionist, they do get pissed off at him.
I wonder how long that'll last, though. I agree they were, and they liked the America First talk and everything. Mm-hmm. But they also bow down to authority. They love Trump.
They do.
Their opinion of Trump doesn't seem to be dependent on what he says or does. Mm-hmm. He reverses on everything. And if he reverses on this and starts to get more involved, they can cloak it as, hey, he's killing Muslims.
Yeah.
And we know they're not fans of them.
Who's the Trump non-interventionist base? Are these people that with names we know, or are they just the random people that read his rallies?
Supposedly random people.
So those random people at his rallies didn't read this article, because it says, first off, New York Times. Number two,
it's probably not
2.5 pages long. And then after that, they probably don't understand, or if you looked into it, they would read to the maybe fifth to sixth paragraph where it said the Obama administration did the same thing at a high scale. And then there's that, wait a second, this doesn't compute. I thought I hate everything that Barack Obama did. Because we never talked about that when Obama was in and said, look how horrible he is. Republican elected officials didn't come out and say, look at all these arms he's selling, he's wasting our money. No, because they liked that part.
Both, mm-hmm.
So what happens on this side, it's look at this new wave of selling arms to our ally to make sure more horrible things don't happen to the region, which then somehow comes back and happens.
He did make one good move, though, in having Jared Kushner be the person to negotiate it. it provided an out for the conspiracy theory InfoWars sector. Because obviously they don't, the idea that Trump, America First Trump is going to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, they hate Saudi Arabia. Oh, but they sent the Jewish guy to do it. So it's Jewish elites. That's what they always say. That's always the out for them.
I thought he was a good one though in their eyes.
No, they fucking hate him.
Really?
Yeah. In the past, when Trump has reversed position on big things that he said he was going to do, the conspiracy theorists always say this is the goddamn Jews in the administration doing it. And they've specifically attacked the effeminate Jared Kushner. Anyway, so expect that that's probably going to happen. Anyway, we have to take our first break. When we come back though, another federal department, especially one that caters to the poor, low income individuals, having its budget slashed. We're going to talk about some of the likely consequences of that when we come back from this break.
All right, welcome back to the Urge. What is this? Who the hell is this guy?
I'm here.
I was thinking that same thing.
So I just want to clarify to the audience that I am not late, I am early. I was supposed to join you guys in the second hour of today's show, but my plane landed a little bit early, so I said,
"Why not?" The host
is
neither late nor early; they arrive exactly when they intend to. See if anybody gets that reference.
Game of Thrones.
No.
Okay.
We'll see. There are nerds in the audience; they'll get the reference. Okay.
Let's go with Jesus reference. He may not be on your time, but he's always right on time.
Oh. Is that Jesus?
That sounds like such a Christian thing to say.
Dad in church growing up all the time.
Yeah, I was making fun of the Muslim saying the other day of if the mountain will not come to Muhammad, Muhammad will go to the mountain. Yeah, no shit, because of course the mountain's like,
Muhammad's not coming.
If the mountain comes to Muhammad, what the fuck?
Right. No, probably. He said, watch, I'll make the mountain come to me. It didn't work. He's like, okay, fuck, we're going to the mountain.
Well, he's reasonable, okay? He adapts.
Anyway, Jordan Hobson.
How did that story turn out?
Turns out they did a long trek to the mountain. Anyway, Jordan Hobson says, brand new member of the Young Turks. Hey, welcome, woo! Jordan. Ready to watch CYT Live Power Panel. Okay, I hope we don't disappoint Jordan. Rebecca Flaherty writes in, POTUS not excited to travel abroad because there are no Trump Tower kitchens to serve him, quote, beautiful chocolate cake. What a child. I know you guys did the story, but we're going to talk about it a little bit more in the second hour.
Because it gets better.
The food angle, yeah.
It's the food angle, that's right.
Yeah.
It's not about the beautiful cake, it's about something else. Okay, from Rebecca Flaherty, we go to Aldawene Chingon, a new book, The Art of the Arms Deal.
How many t-shirts has Duende Chingon gotten by now?
He gets read twice a day.
I'm not sure El Duende's ever gotten any t-shirts, which is perhaps a crime.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then we will continue.
Yes. Anyways, all right, what's next, John?
Okay. This is not positive news, I'm sorry. It probably shouldn't be a surprise at this point, but one of the federal departments in charge of making housing affordable and accessible, especially to lower and middle income individuals, is up for a potential massive cut in its budget. It's the Department of Housing and Urban Development, headed up by Ben Carson. And earlier this month, a draft of the proposed budget came out. The request cuts funding by $6 billion for 2018 to about $40 billion. So we're talking about, like, I'm terrible at math. I'm going to say between 15 and 18% of its entire budget being cut. A HUD spokesman did not respond to requests for comment, perhaps understandably. The biggest cut to the department would eliminate the $3 billion Community Development Block Grant Program, a state and local entitlement that benefits low and moderate income communities, including building roads, sewers, and housing in those areas. But don't worry, Ben Carson says, yeah, we're cutting the budget by billions of dollars, but the private sector will come in and build those sewers for free, presumably. Yeah. I don't know why. So again, you're not only not getting the money for the government, but then those states and localities are going to have to pay massively to private companies to build roads and sewers and those sorts of things. But additionally, rental assistance to tenants, another big part of HUD's mission, would fall by $974 million. And capital funding for public housing would fall by two-thirds. So again, that's sort of the last note here, but one of the most important components of HUD is providing that initial capital funding so that you can get new housing, especially in areas with massively rising populations. to cut it by two-thirds, I mean, they're not hiding at all. There's no subtlety to how little they care about the interests of some of the lowest income individuals in America who depend on this sort of funding for initial access to housing, that it exists there at all, and when it's there, that they can actually afford the rent.
Well, to be fair, this isn't just targeting people in a lower socioeconomic part of our country, you know. I'm sure in Beverly Hills, they stopped upkeeping all the parks. The grass is growing, the trees are shedding, and none of it's getting picked up. And you know what's gonna happen? The people in Beverly is gonna come out and cut those lawns themselves and clean up their own stuff. They're not gonna complain at all. They're gonna say, this is our community. We're proud of it. We're gonna take care of it. We don't pay any taxes. It's okay.
So bootstraps, that's what they're gonna do.
They see if
there's one thing I know about Beverly Hills, it's bootstraps. Okay, you know the howling that would happen if you actually did this to any rich neighborhood? Yeah. Anyway, first of all, they're just shifting money around. You're not actually saving money if you're a taxpayer. They say, oh, well, the state and local authorities have to pick up the slack. And private, like John said, why would a private corporation build a sewer? Unless they were then going to charge you for that sewer for the rest of your life.
Yes.
And charge you way more than it would have cost you if the government built it.
Like when you set up a toll road, it's pitched as saving money. You get a little bit of investment of community, and then the individual people have to pay for that for the next century.
Yeah, so you actually pay more under that circumstance. And so you say, oh yeah, I'm gonna lower your taxes. Actually, they're lowering the tax on the incredibly rich. But anyway, but if that were true, state and local taxes would have to go up because somebody's gotta build roads. We need roads and we need upkeep of roads, etc. Come on, you know that, right? So that's one portion of it. The other is that when they make all those promises when they're getting confirmed, you know, and some people talk to Ben Carson, and you know, he earnestly says, no, I care about the poor and the middle class, and I'm gonna do my job here. And then some Democratic senators come out and go, I talked to him, we had a heart to heart. They had no heart to heart, guys. Of course they were gonna slash the budget, and they were gonna slash it monstrously. All the stuff they say in confirmation hearings is totally useless nonsense. I can't stand it when the politicians pretend that there's a human being there that they're having a conversation with that you could reason with. No, they said they were gonna brutalize the housing and urban development budget, and they brought in Ben Carson to do exactly that so that they could say, no, it's okay, a black guy did it, it's okay, right?
Yeah.
It must be reasonable if that's what happened. And finally, from my perspective, be careful what you wish for, Trump administration, because they, you know, in their racist mindset, you know, whenever Trump talks about the cities, he's like, oh, they're burning, oh, the crime, the inner cities. He means black people, right? Mm-hmm. And so when he talks about the poor, he almost always talks about black people. But the reality is the majority of the poor in this country are white.
Yeah.
Of course, the majority of the whole country is white, right? And so when you cut these guys' housing, well, the number one demographic other than white evangelical Christians for Donald Trump in terms of the vote he got was uneducated whites. Who are these folks? A lot of them are uneducated whites, Trump voters.
Yeah.
So when you all of a sudden Trump voters turn around and they don't have a house anymore and the sewers aren't working and there's giant potholes in the road, they go, what happened? Well, you happened. You voted for Trump and this is what happens.
Yeah.
So this is a bigger problem than even this, because that's why housing prices are so high in America and many places. They're artificially inflated because we're not building low-income housing. We're not building affordable housing, even Democratic mayors and what have you. So there's no plan. You know, I just read the Labour Party's platform over in England, and they actually have built into their platform thousands of housing for first-time homebuyers, which is there's a big barrier to entry for first-time homebuyers in the United States, mm-hmm. which was exacerbated by Barack Obama bailing out the private equity firm Blackstone on his way out the door, which keeps prices artificially high because now they're doing rentals the way they used to do bundling with houses. They're doing that with rentals now. Anyway, we don't build low income housing anymore, which we need to do. And in the Labour Party's platform in England, they have also thousands of new housing for what they call rough sleepers. And that's called, that's what they call homeless people. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. So they actually have in their platform, we need to build affordable housing. It would be great to see a political party in the United States say the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, we're getting here a pretty clear idea of the vision for the future. I mean, we've talked about the huge tax cuts that are coming in raw form, the tax cuts that are coming as a result of the AHCA, the new Republican healthcare bill. So if you're rich in America, you're gonna get a fabulous amount of extra money showered onto you. And then you have the willingness on this at the same time to massively increase homelessness. I mean, think about the crime that's going to come about as a result of this when people are thrown out of their housing. They have nowhere else to turn. I mean, you can't cut billions and billions of dollars away from these programs and not expecting negative outcomes. Now, unfortunately, the people who are going to suffer even from those secondary outcomes in a lot of cases are also poor people. That's what's so bad about it. But the rich can't simply hide in their penthouses for all time. If they burn this country to the ground, if they put people in incredibly dire straits, some of that eventually is going to come back to the rich. And we've seen that throughout history time and time again as countries go under because of policies like this. They can be insulated from the crime, through the, from the violence, but not forever. It's incredibly short-sighted.
No, there's a country though that's figured it out where there's almost no regulation at all. And the rich get to keep all, anything they want, but the poor don't get anything. But that's okay. It worked out pretty nicely in Somalia. Okay. Yeah. Poor and Somalia. So, I keep picking on him.
Mark Blythe is a political economist who's famous for coining the term global Trumpism. He predicted Brexit. He predicted Trump. And he has a funny thing. He says the Hamptons, he tells the rich people in America, the Hamptons are not a defensible position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. It's a low-lying area.
It is, actually. Yeah. Yes. Okay, we do have to take our second break of the hour, though. But when we come back, we've got the fight for a higher minimum wage in Missouri and a really unfortunate, at least temporary outcome in that fight in Missouri. We're going to give you the updates when we come back from this break. So.
All right, back on the Young Turks. Derek Martin writes in, we blame Trump and company, but this is DC business as usual. When are the 99% going to flip the monopoly board on the 1%? Hold. Well, look, that's what I try to explain to folks. I don't mean just you guys. I mean like when, when I'm in Washington, New York, et cetera, right? Like, we're not here to hurt them, man. We're here to help fix the system. Because if the system doesn't get fixed, right behind us is us is pitchforks. And they're just, they're not getting it, right? They think we're the pitchforks. No. There's other pitchforks, and that's when people stop having rational conversations. But they, to them, they're like, I don't understand. Everything is so great.
Yeah.
right? And I'm like, I know you, it's great for you. And so I read the story. Anyway, it's in the second hour. This woman, it's this one right now, the Missouri one coming up. So we'll talk about it in a second. So anyway, John Connor writes in, yep, Cenk arrives and needs to take over the panel. The show is this. Precious. Okay. What? All right, John, I see you. Okay, speaking of
no t-shirt.
Lord of the Rings, Sauron writes in, that was John's reference to Lord of the Rings, the Fellowship of the Ring. I got your back, John.
Thank you. So Sauron, you said that?
Yeah.
Spooky. Yeah, it was a Gandalf quote, which I misquoted, but anyway.
I've heard nothing but Charlie Brown's teacher for the past 5 minutes. We'll talk about.
There's a lot of nerds in the audience, okay? I'm speaking to my people.
The king of the nerds.
Thank you.
All right, forward.
Okay, let's jump into it. Back in 2015, there was this long fight. You had labor activists and Democratic politicians in Missouri fighting to finally raise the minimum wage there. It'd been incredibly low, less than $8. And we know in America, it's incredibly hard to raise the minimum wage because instantly when you try to, the Chamber of Commerce fights against you. Republicans obviously fight against you. And so they actually did it. They got the raise. But don't get too excited yet because immediately there was legal challenges to it, funded again by the Chamber of Commerce. So they initially passed it. It was going to be $9 an hour that year, then $10 an hour this year, $11 next year. We're not talking about massive increases. That's not $12. That's not, you know, fight for $15, but it's something. And a big percentage increase. If you're making $7.90 an hour, $11 changes your life. That changes your quality of life at that point. But unfortunately, when they passed it, it passed on the very same day that the state's preemption law, which blocks cities and localities from increasing their own wages, took effect. After a consortium of business groups sued to block the increase, it was under an injunction until a judge in February finally ruled in favor of the increase. And it immediately took effect a little bit earlier this year. So again, good news, but again, don't get too excited because Missouri lawmakers on Friday sent a bill banning local minimum wages increases to the governor with minutes left to spare in the legislative session. And so you had attempts by Democrats to filibuster that, to do procedural changes, to try to stop that from passing before the end of the legislative session, but they were not successful. They're in the minority, and it did actually go to the governor, where it's expected to be signed. And they predict now a jarring change may be ahead for workers and businesses who may immediately revert back to the state minimum wage of $7.70 an hour.
Why would they do that? You know, local businesses, not even local, any business. You know what they're always looking out for is their employees.
They love their employees.
If you give them the power to sweepingly do whatever they want to their employees, they're going to appreciate them and pay them more. What are you talking about? If we stop forcing them with these overregulations of companies, then they'll actually do right by the workers. Why would they go down to $7.70? Who came up with that number? They're nice guys.
Willingly go to 15 an hour.
Yeah, they didn't state the nice guy number in the article. Yeah.
They did not.
Yeah.
No.
So, you know, and all, of course, the business always say it's propaganda. Oh, we're going to go out of business if you increase the wages too much. But it's just, all you got to do is look at their numbers, because they have to report them every quarter, right, by law. So you know how much money McDonald's makes. You can look at every one of those companies. And you know that if you increase the minimum wage, how much it would increase their labor costs. And you know that, yes, that would cost them some of money. You know where that goes? It goes to you guys. It goes to everybody who works minimum wage. And you know what would happen after that? They would still make billions upon billions of dollars in profits. They all would, right? So they're just saying, hey, why don't the executives get to keep those billions of dollars? Because they'll create more jobs by buying more yachts instead of you guys. No, but if they actually, not only is that wrong morally, it's wrong economically. Because if the woman making $7.70 an hour keeps that, she's going to spend every nickel of it because she has to for food, clothes.
She's not going
to
hide it in the Cayman Islands.
Right?
She's not going to immediately put it somewhere. Some of it will go to McDonald's, actually.
And when she spends that money, it gets recirculated in the economy and actually does a world of good for the economy, and much more so than when rich people save that money.
Yeah.
Okay, and then finally, from my perspective, and we'll all talk it through, obviously, but is that just know what you're getting when you vote for a Republican. And it's okay if you say, yeah, I like a really low minimum wage, and I don't want people to make too much money, even if they're working their ass off, they're working 40, 50, 60 hours a week, they're working two minimum wage jobs, I don't care. I want to have them make as little money as possible, because I just don't think executives get paid enough. Okay, fine, no problem. But just understand what you're voting for, because Republicans vote against minimum wage all across the country. They do it all the time, they do it universally. And here in Missouri, if you're a minimum wage worker, they just took essential money out of your pocket that you need to live and to survive, and they put it in the pockets of executives in companies that are already incredibly profitable.
They just took like 25 or 30% of their income theoretically away.
So they just
casually, I mean, at the end of legislative session.
If somebody came up to you in the street and took away 25% of your income, you know what you'd call them? A robber. You'd say, I got mugged. You'd want them in prison. But if you vote for Republicans, that's what they're doing. If you're in this, and it, by the way, I don't make minimum wage, but I actually care about people who make minimum wage and working their ass off and barely surviving. So if you're in that category, or you're a decent human being and you care about folks in that category, understand what you do when you're voting Republican. I don't care anything else. You say, oh, no, but I don't know, Jesus told me or Yahweh told me. I don't, whatever it is your excuse for voting Republican, it's fine, go ahead and do it. But understand that you just robbed these incredibly hardworking people of about 25% of their salary. Yeah. That's what you just did.
And they went through a lot of energy to do so. As you point out, I want to put her name out there. The state senator, Jamila Nasheed, she was a Democrat that was fighting for this and pushed for, she had a 2-hour filibuster and trying to make this happen. And they invoked this late maneuver at the end of the day to make sure that they voted in, as you said, just today, to make sure that they reverted back to the status of screwing people over. It's not even like a casual, let's go through it and make it happen. Let's make sure we evoke everything we can to screw people over and make sure they're making $7.70 an hour.
Yeah. Senator Nasheed was the good guy,
yeah,
who was.
She fought, and then they went after
she
her.
She fought to try to protect, maintain the minimum wage increase, which was already passed.
Even Claire McCaskill, who is considered to be a conservative Democrat, she's a strong supporter of the minimum wage. In fact, that helped get her elected. Because whenever you put the minimum wage on the ballot, It's a winner for Democrats. It increases voter participation. You get a higher turnout. And the whoever is advocating for the minimum wage wins.
Yes.
So it's popular all the time. In fact, in 2006, when she was running against Jim Talent in Missouri, Claire McCaskill said, I'm not going to take a congressional pay raise until we have a national pay raise for the minimum wage. Jim Talent voted against the minimum wage increase 11 times while taking a $31,000 raise in his congressional page at the same time. Now we have Claire McCaskill. It's time for her to stand up about this.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, look, there is coming up later this year, I believe in August, it might be August 8th, there's going to be another ballot measure to try to do a little more limited version of this specific to Kansas City. That ballot measure would boost Kansas City's minimum wage to $10 per hour September 1st and incrementally going up to reach 15 by 2022. So
it's right around the corner.
A bigger ceiling, I guess. It's going to take a long time and it doesn't help people who live in some of the other incredibly large cities in Missouri, let alone everyone else.
Sadly, those folks who are trying to make more money are going to go buy microwaves and TVs.
Yeah, they're probably going to buy a washer and dryer. You know, FDR said that a business that can't pay a living wage doesn't deserve to be in business.
Yeah.
And that's true. You know, it's this revoking the minimum wage hurts their economy. Yeah. It's going to hurt their economy. It's called demand side. It's what FDR did. He put money in the pockets of workers. They spent it. It's called velocity of money. It's demand economy. That's what helps boost. You know, once we went into the supply side, our economy has not been good for workers. That's why we have a bigger income disparity since the Gilded Age. It's because we're not doing demand side economy anymore. We're not doing Keynesian economy. We're not doing what FDR did. We're doing what Bill Clinton did, which was what Ronald Reagan did, which is give all the money to the richest people in the country.
And when FDR did do that, we were the number one economy in the world and we exploded in growth. So that you can say, oh, that's because of the war. You can say all these different things. But the bottom line is, they say, oh, that would hurt the economy. It most certainly did not hurt the economy when you actually looked out for American workers. When FDR did that, it led to the greatest boom maybe in world history for the American workers. And created a middle class like the world has never seen before.
Also, what boomed the economy was they gave everybody coming back from World War II free college. Mm-hmm. People forget that. We had a whole generation go to college for free.
And helped them buy houses.
And helped them buy houses, and it built a middle class. So we're not doing any of that stuff anymore. Yeah.
And if minimum wage just kept up with inflation, it'd be over $20 now. So now if you're looking at it $15, you say, oh, wow, that sounds like a lot. It only sounds like a lot because they've spent all these decades crushing you.
Yeah.
In reality, if he just kept up with minimum wage, it'd be over 20 with inflation, right? And so they just brutalized you. And that's why when you see the charts of American productivity and then American wages, it starts to separate in 1980 when they start doing supply side economics.
Yeah.
And the difference between those two things is you worked your ass off. American productivity is still amazing,
yes,
still fantastic. But you didn't get the wages for it. You know what the difference between those two lines are? $12 trillion. They took $12 trillion from American workers and they moved it to the top. Okay? So that's why, like in this Think Progress piece, there's this woman, Betty Douglas, that they followed. And she can't afford to take the bus to work anymore. So you see the vicious cycle? Then they say, oh yeah, bootstraps. But she's working her ass off.
Yeah.
And now they shut off her water. She's like, I don't know how I'm going to get the $50 needed to turn the water back on, let alone pay that bill.
Right.
My kids don't have enough food, and I no longer have enough money to take the bus to work. And they say, oh yeah, she's getting too much. Oh, for Christ's sake, man. We've lost our humanity. And in the meanwhile, we've also lost our economic boom because we're doing the wrong economic principles, and it's not helping anyone.
Except for the wealthiest people in the country.
For a while,
yeah,
until things crash.
And let's exactly. Keep with the aspect of that last, the story about that woman. She's been in that job for 10 years and is going to have to, whatever minimum wage they decide to push on her now, she's going to have to go to that on top of all of this. So it's not as a matter of her being lazy. She doesn't want to stay in the job and work your way. And once you start in, you know, you start at the bottom and you make your way to the top. Not in this world.
She worked and worked and worked and they fuck you.
She worked the job for 10 years and she's all the way up to $7.90. Okay, let's do the last story quick on Lieberman.
Okay, we might soon have a new head of the FBI, and according to the White House and sources who are in the know on this, there's a good chance it's going to be Joseph Lieberman. Joe Lieberman, who I seriously thought that we were done with as a country. Former senator, obviously, if you're not familiar with him, I'm going to quickly catch you up just a little bit. Back during the when he was a senator, a lot of Democrats didn't like him, still don't. There are some good reasons. He supported the Iraq War, perhaps even more heavily than George W. Bush himself did. That's one of the reasons he was primaried back in 2006 and lost to Ned Lamont, who was a strongly anti-war candidate. So he lost. Then, against the Howard Dean, the chair of the DNC's wishes, he fought in the general election against the guy who beat him in the primary under the Connecticut for Lieberman party and won again. He introduced a bill to allow members of WikiLeaks and others to be prosecuted under the Espionage Act, favored heavily increased domestic surveillance. Gee, I wonder if being the head of the FBI is going to come into play with those views. Threatened to filibuster to stop the public option in 2009 from being a part of the healthcare bill. And he's believed to have been a part of the agreement that stripped it out so that we didn't have a public option. And introduced a bill to grant the president a kill switch on the internet. He's going to be the head of the FBI, theoretically.
This is the
short list I put together mostly from memory. We can fill it in some more. He not only has no qualifications whatsoever in terms of a law enforcing background or anything like that. He's a politician, obviously, a politician who's hated very broadly. Now, some people like him, to be fair. Senator Susan Collins called him a person of unquestioned integrity, and that's what we need. Lindsey Graham said if the president picked Joe Lieberman, he'd be doing the country a good service. And I think the FBI a good service. But Democrats not happy about it. Senator Sherrod Brown said he's the reason we lost Medicare at 55. Couldn't have had anything to do with the insurance industry lobbying in Hartford. I'm sure Lieberman couldn't succumb to that. So we wouldn't have had Medicare for all, but we would have had Medicare for many more if not for Joe Lieberman. Dick Durbin said we ought to stay away from political figures, all the voting history, all the party history, whatever it is, I would stay away from it, stick with the professionals. And even Joe Manchin says any other time, man, Joe is an excellent, excellent choice, but not here.
Wow.
Even Joe Manchin is not having it.
So everyone who said nice things about him was Republican. Yes. So just to be clear. And it's funny, you reminded me of that race. Now, the establishment says primaries are bad. And then, my God, if you run an independent campaign in the general election, that is the worst of the worst. Oh. Like Jill Stein, et cetera, the worst. But funny enough, when Joe Lieberman ran as an independent and endangered the chances of the Democrats winning a seat in Connecticut, which they should have locked up. Yes, Howard Dean was against it, but the rest of the establishment was like, oh, Joe is so brave and so persistent. Yeah. Way to go get him, Joe.
Well, he has Joe Mentum. Apparently, Hillary Clinton spoke out against it, shockingly. Yeah.
So, a little bit different depending on who the candidate is, right? And whether they're actually progressive or not. And it, you know, that Medicare for at 55, like John said, millions, tens of millions of people could have been affected if we said instead of getting Medicare at 65, you'll get it at 55. All we needed was one more vote, and Joe Lieberman was theoretically caucusing with the Democrats, and by the way, he was Barack Obama's mentor in the Senate, and in that moment, I don't know whether Obama agreed with him or not. I mean, he appeared to not agree with him, but he turned around and screwed over all of the Democrats. And said, nope, we're not going to do Medicare for 55 because that would hurt my donors who are the insurance lobbyists. He is the worst.
And think about, I mean, look, obviously that screwed over, as you said, tens of millions of Americans. But it also sets a precedent whereby apparently from time to time we lower that age. And so if you've lowered it down to 55, then theoretically in a couple of years you can lower it to 50 and you can lower it some more. But we didn't have that in large part because of Joe Lieberman.
So is this Joe Lieberman, he's literally for money denying health care to poor people, literally for money, and people die. So is he better or worse than just a regular criminal? Is he better or worse than someone who
robs a bank? Has a bigger effect than a lot of regular criminals.
He's hurting more people than a guy who robs a bank. He's hurting more people than someone who stabs someone and robs their wallet. He's hurting more people than a rapist. He's worse than all those people, and he's doing it for fucking money. Yeah. And somebody has to say something in public life that you can't screw over your own country for money, and then you're accepted in polite society. That guy's a piece of garbage for what he did. It's not okay.
You know what's ironic is that for saying that, you would be ostracized from Washington 1,000 times more than he would.
Yes.
Yeah. Because the effect of his policy, because they think it's all a game. You know, that's why I get mad at the Breitbarts and all that stuff. It's not a, and the Ann Coulters and all those. It's not a game. It actually affects people. Yeah. So many people didn't get health care because Joe Lieberman was the vote that blocked that bill. If he had voted the right way, all those people could have gotten health care. It would have been more affordable. And by the way, the American government would have saved all this money, et cetera, et cetera. But he does that and they say, well, that's the honorable gentleman from Connecticut. It's okay, we all know Joe. If Jimmy says what he just said, they say, oh my God, what is wrong with you? That is Joe Lieberman. How dare you talk about him that
impolite.
Way? Why? Why? Because they know Joe Lieberman, and so if they know him and you offend him, well, that they feel like that's a crime. All those other people who didn't get insurance because of Joe Lieberman, all the people who died in the Iraq War, hundreds of thousands of civilians, they don't know.
Yeah,
they don't know him at all. So Joe Lieberman helped to put all that into effect and did it for his own financial gain. They're like, hey, that's how Washington is. And Jimmy, on the other hand, is a monster for criticizing. Yeah. In the terms that he does, the people who make those decisions. How dare you? That's the game we're all playing.
And so, look, that's probably the single worst thing that he did, but I cited a lot of specifically areas where he has supported massive expansions of executive power, ability to take away any sense of privacy you have in terms of electronics, phone calls, all that. I mean, he has been consistent throughout his career in favor of giving groups like the FBI and the president, regardless of party, the ability to shut down the internet, to spy into what you've said and done. If people leak information, he wants them locked up. He has very little respect for journalists or whistleblowers. And those are areas specifically where, if he was the head of the FBI, he would be able to enshrine those draconic policies into our government. Like, these are not just hypothetical bad things that he did. He specifically is unqualified and horrific in the position that he's being offered, apparently.
But all of that, it pales in comparison to the one reason why he shouldn't be the head of the FBI now. He's working at Trump's law firm. The law firm that represents Trump is where Lieberman works. You can't put your own lawyer as the head of the FBI. Why are we having this conversation?
Because it's Trump.
That's mental. That's mental.
But if you say no, they go, how dare you? This guy was elected. He can do what he wants. And of course, the honorable Joe Lieberman. Now, this answers the question of whether or not, after he fired Comey, whether or not this had anything to do with taking some heat off them. We're like, well, we'll see. It'll be confirmed. You guys just wait. It'll be confirmed once we see who he nominates.
Well, now we know. He hired his own lawyer, basically. Yeah. So, gee, I wonder if that guy will be independent.
So not only did he stand in front of Medicare for all, he stood in front of the public option for all. He expanded their surveillance state, put whistleblowers in jail. He also was the sponsor for Betsy DeVos for when she came to her Senate hearing. Do people remember that? He was the one who ushered her in.
I forgot that.
Yeah, so he is, again, he couldn't, he's the worst of the worst. And by the way, let's remember how bad the Democratic Party is. He was their frickin' vice presidential choice in 2000. That's how corporate he screwed up that Al Gore and Bill Clinton took the Democratic Party, which is why we have Trump.
Whoa, whoa, easy on Al Gore. All right, so super last thing. When he was running for president in 2004, he got slaughtered because no actual voter likes him. Okay, it's only the Morning Joe crowd that likes
him. Donors like him.
Yeah, and so
momentum.
He's from Connecticut. No, this is the best part.
Momentum.
He's from Connecticut, so they thought he would win, and he was the vice presidential candidate for the Democrats in 2000. So they thought he'd have New Hampshire locked up. Instead, he came in fifth. And in the press conference after the election, he said, no, this is great news. It was basically a three-way tie for third. So we have Momentum. Oh,
some
dude, that's so embarrassing.
Glass half full people. By the way, we should ask Michael Schur if he can name the four that beat him. I bet he can.
Oh, yeah, that's
he
good.
Loves that.
I'll try to do it during the break. Yeah. All right, thank you all, you guys. Great work. Jimmy Dore Show.
We in San Francisco, July 15th. Go to jimmydorecomedy.com.
There you go. You know where JR is.
Oh, can I plug the event?
Yes.
So I'm going to be gone for a little bit over a week. Some of that is setting up for a big event later this year, which I don't think we've really talked about. But starting next week and into the following week, myself and Shavala, who's worked with TYT before, we're traveling to Norway to cover the Oslo Freedom Forum. It's a global yearly gathering of human rights activists and journalists and artists. And so we're going to be doing interviews and live broadcasts of their speeches and their panels. And it is going to be awesome. Shavala and I are also going to be doing a Europe focused episode of the Young Turks from Norway.
Living it out.
All right, go see John in Oslo. And we have a story about Norway coming up in the second hour, which is really, really interesting. So, all right, we'll be right back, guys.